Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Peter Finch. KFOG Radio News Director here in San Francisco. It is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speakers for our program celebrating the Summer of Love at 40, the Roots of a Counterculture. First up, Dr. David E. Smith, Executive Medical Director of the Prometa Center for Addiction and founder of the Haight-Ashbury Free Medical Clinic. We also have with us this evening Wes Scoopnisker, author, radio commentator, and former news director of the Jive 95, KSAN Radio, back in the day. Also on our panel this evening, Paul Krasner, writer and founder of The Realist Magazine. Last but not least, and we'll have to check the Commonwealth archives to see if he's the first panel to be resplendent in tie-dye, head-to-toe, activist, clown, and former frozen dessert, Wavy Gravy. In the summer of 1967, kids from all over the country converged on San Francisco and laid the foundation for a socio-political legacy. 40 years later, decisions made during the Summer of Love continue to have an impact on our lives. Music, drugs, and politics was the theme, and it all converged on the corner of Haight and Ashbury, right here in San Francisco, California. Tonight we take a look back through the haze at the Summer of Love, and please, one more time, welcome all our panelists, Dr. David E. Smith, Scoopnisker, Paul Krasner, and Wavy Gravy.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah.
And I want to begin by having each of you tell us what you were doing in the summer of 67. I'm presuming that you were all here. I'm not sure, though. I know that Scoopnisker has written that he came to San Francisco to be a bohemian, got here late, and was assigned to the hippies. So, Scoop, maybe on that note, maybe I'll begin with you. Where did the summer... I know you attended the Monterey Pop Festival. I know that much.
That was my introduction to San Francisco, California, hippies. I mean, not actually hippies. I was living in Minneapolis and hanging out with a small group of people who were smoking pot and being politically active raising some trouble. And a friend of mine ran a magazine called Twin Beat, a rock and roll magazine. He got invited to cover the Monterey Pop Festival, and he said, "You want to go?" And so we all piled into a old Buick and headed for Monterey. And we got here, and it was like heaven. Like we had finally found our people, our home. It's like the promised land. And I remember going to the Monterey Pop Festival, and there was maybe a 20 foot high Buddha at the entrance, and people were handing out corsages, orchids to everyone who came. They had shipped all these orchids in from Hawaii. And then after the pop festival, I went to the Haight-Ashbury and never looked back. Well, I looked back, but I didn't go back.
Now, out of the corner of my eye, when I mentioned I presume you were all here for Summer of Love, Wavy Gravy, I may have seen you shake your head. No, were you still Hugh at the time, or were you Wavy by then?
I was Hugh. I did not become Wavy Gravy until the fall of 69. I got that name from B.B. King at the Texas Pop Festival. He says, "You Wavy Gravy." Yes, sir. And he leaned me up against his amplifier and took out Lucille, and from out of the other side came Johnny Winter, and they played till sunrise, and it was everybody's reward for putting on their pants.
Paul Krasner, summer of 67. And I guess this question is both physical and metaphysical for all of you. Where were you at that time?
Metaphysical. I was at the expo in Montreal, had been invited to speak at the youth pavilion, and I was being interviewed by the CBC. And a friend had given me a capsule of LSD, which had been distributed by the mafia, so he wanted me to test it. And so I took it right before the interview on CBC, and this was in the middle of the Vietnam War, and so I said in the middle of the interview that I'd like to burn my draft card now. And the guy got all excited interviewing me because he says, oh, we have a scoop. Not you. Or your flavor, for that matter.
Yum, yum, the dessert mantra, yum.
And
yum.
So, never give a straight line to a psychedelic relic.
And Temple of Accumulated Error.
And so I made the point that, you know, people would object to this, but it's just a piece of cardboard, and there were actual children being burned to death by napalm on the other side of the globe. And so you had to remember the difference between symbols and flesh. So I just try to give it a context. And they had a Marine guarding the American pavilion where I was being interviewed who had gone to protocol school. But he wasn't used to, they didn't teach him about somebody taking acid during an interview. So he called the captain and said, he burned his draft card, sir. And I said, no, here is my draft card, because I had been speaking at a lot of campuses at the time and had a lot of photostats made so that I... So the lieutenant said, sir, I saw him burn his card, I saw him. I said, no, that was a photostat. And so the captain said, well, you know, a photostat, it's against the law to make a copy of your draft card. I said, yeah, what? I burned the evidence. And anyway, just to cut to the end of that, I called my friend and told him that although I disapprove of the mafia's methods and their goals, they did distribute some pretty powerful acid.
Where I was in Sunland, California. My wife and I had moved away from the whole scene, the dead, the acid test, all that stuff. We were leaving a bucolic existence in this little tiny cabin when we got the call that they were doing a photo shoot for Life magazine of psychedelica, and the pranksters and the dead wanted us to come in and pose with them. So we just jalopied in, and there we all were posing for a cover of Life magazine, and Ken Babbs steals the bus to join Kesey, who was on the lam in Mexico. So my wife and I suddenly have 47 house guests. The landlord comes by and says, you can't have 50 people living in one room, you're evicted. And an hour and a half later, this is kitchen synchronicity at work, Paul, Bud Pelsu, a neighbor, comes by. Old Saul up on the mountain had a stroke that needs somebody to slop them hogs. And so we were given a mountaintop rent-free if we would take care of 60 hogs the size of dinosaurs, and one of which we later ran for president. She was the first female black and white candidate. We broke a lot of ground with the pig, yeah.
That was wavy gravy. Dr. David E. Smith, founder of the Haight-Ashbury Free Medical Clinic, and it wasn't a case of you seeking out the Summer of Love in San Francisco as much as the Summer of Love came to you. As I understand it, you had inherited a home right there in the neighborhood, correct?
Yes, I have a very different background than these gentlemen.
For the radio audience, he's the only one wearing a tie right, this evening.
But it is it's a Fillmore psychedelic tie. But I've lived in Haight-Ashbury since 1960 when I started medical school, and all interacted and admired these gentlemen during that period of time. I wish they would have recorded the backstage with all the stories that were flying around. But I was doing drug research at UC San Francisco. I was a local LSD expert and was taking LSD and white mice. And then I would walk home at night. And I was also running the alcohol and drug abuse screening unit in San Francisco. So I was there. In fact, at age 68, father of four, grandfather of three, I can remember 67 better than I can remember yesterday. It was an incredible time. And what my recollections were that there was these hundreds of thousands of kids coming in. And I think one of the things that the audience must recognize is the Haight-Ashbury had a rich history way before the Summer of Love. I think that's lost in all of this recent expose. The Upper Haight-Ashbury was very politically active. They had the, quote, party people. Terrence Hallinan and his father were there. The late American labor movement started there with Harry Bridges. And I'm so different in the background of these gentlemen because I didn't have one shred of political activism in my background. I was a physician, scientist, aimed for academic medicine, but I got my education in the Haight-Ashbury because I would come home and there was Terrence Hallinan from San Francisco State talking about Mississippi Freedom Rider registered for voting. Well, with Paul and Scoop and Wavy, they knew all about that. I didn't. My grandparents were farm workers from Oklahoma. It's the farthest thing in my mind from political activism. But I learned about segregated health care. That's where I got the idea that coining the term health care is a right, not a privilege, which I coined the starting of the Haight-Ashbury for clinics. So it was an incredibly rich and fertile time, but I remember coming home, and probably Wavy was there, because when you talk with Wavy, he talks, you listen. And but it was like this human being, and everybody was tripping, and there was Timothy Leary and Allen Ginsberg, and then there was everybody's passing the electric acid Kool-Aid test. He put LSD in Kool-Aid. And remember, I was the one that said this is a very powerful drug, and you got to be careful. Well, everybody's putting it in the Kool-Aid, and there was a guy in the back having a death rebirth experience, and I went, something's going on here, you know. It was a totally mind-blowing experience, and I think the cultural history is how it's impacted on the mainstream of society has been lost. The first light show I ever saw was a simulated LSD experience by Dick Hamm, just outside the Haight-Ashbury. Bill Hamm, yeah. I remember walking down there. And there's some old-timers that remember that. That was before all of this mainstream things, and it was incredible. And that simulated the light shows with Bill Graham, who's the one that did all the benefits for us. And I went to the city and said, all these hippies are coming. They don't have health care. And they said, well, we can't start a clinic because they'll just stay, and we don't want them to stay. And I had learned from Terrence Hallinan that that's not the right thing to do after spiritual experience I had. So they said, well, if you start a private doctor's office, you can call it anything you want. So 558 Clayton Street was the David E. Smith, MD, and associates doing business at the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic. And the associates were some of the strangest associates you've ever seen in your life. And that was the beginning. We had about a month survival time. And Bill Graham, who I think history has not given him a fair shake either. He had a heart of gold. If you were on his side, he organized all our benefits. He's the one that got Jefferson Airplane, Creedence Clearwater, Grateful Dead. He's the one that basically did the benefits. George Harrison, Ravi Shankar. He's the one that did the benefits to keep
and Chet Helms, please. And
Chet Helms is great too.
Yeah.
Well, Avalon and those things, that was the beginning of the free clinic movement that's now spread nationwide. Over 2,000 free clinics nationwide. That was the beginnings of the field of addiction medicine. And I just want to make sure that the social action out of the hate doesn't get lost when we're talking about the cultural aspects. Some incredible things went on there.
Very good.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking tonight with Dr. David E. Smith, Scoop Nisker, Paul Krasner, and Wavy Gravy, celebrating the summer of love at 40, the roots of a counterculture. And I can see already we're going to have trouble cramming all these great stories into 1 hour. It's almost like we should make this like Woodstock and stretch it out for 3 days, and rain can fall from the ceiling.
Keep off
we can
the
bring
towers.
In mud. Oh, Wavy, you might know
keep
a little
off
about
the towers.
Yeah, there you go.
All right. And be sure not to ingest the brown antacid.
Will Billy meet Emily at the information?
We live at a time these days when parents and their kids are likely to go catch a Rolling Stones concert together, you know? 67, it was a very different time. And you were all, you know, by the time 67 rolled around, you were all adults. But for those of you whose parents were still around at that time, what did they make of you, and what was happening, and how did they handle it? Whoever wants to address that can.
Well, I remember I used to go Studio City, where my wife was shooting Star Trek, and I'd be standing there in a suit, believe it or not, usually reserved for Halloween. And I had a picture of a napalm child and a body count, and people would spit on me. They would just spit on me, and I'd go home and scrape the spit off and go back the next day and do it again. And I remember that. And I remember toward the end of things, when it was cranking down, when I was in Washington, D.C. to MC the impeachment of Richard Nixon, and there were Cub Scouts doing Let's Sink Dick. And I was going to assassinate Nixon, actually, with a Bic pen. They had an ad on TV where they would take a Bic pen and shoot it through a board and write with it. And I'd say, eat Bic, Dick. It's mightier than the sword. Pow! But Ram Dass talked me out of it. You must love Nixon. And so this was a challenge. And I got this Nixon mask, this light-up dick head. And I would smear a tiger bomb on Nixon's third... It's like hippie Vicks on Nixon's third eye. And I, dick, dick, dick. And I started to laugh at Nixon, and it made it possible for me to press on, because laughter is like the valve on the pressure cooker of life. And either you laugh at this stuff or you're going to end up with your brains or your beans on the ceiling. So there.
Yeah. Well, and the follow-up, I guess, getting back to the question,
what
were your parents?
What?
Scoop, I'll ask you. Your folks, were they still back in Nebraska at the time?
They were. And no matter what I was doing, all they would talk about was my hair. You know, of course. I once told my mother, you know, Mom, I do smoke marijuana. And she didn't respond at all. She just said, when are you going to get a haircut? When are you going to get... Your hair, you look so strange with that. I had a Jufro, we called them, you know? And I could still have one if I wanted.
And Paul, did...
I tried to be honest with my parents, and I told them I had just taken LSD for the first time. And she was very concerned. She said that it could lead to marijuana, and she was right.
I've got all these great questions, but we're getting questions from the audience. And
let me just add
one
thing.
I'm
there.
Sorry,
I have
go
a different
ahead,
again
Dr.
a
Smith.
Different perspective. It's not a conflict, but my parents died when I was young. I grew up alone. My parents died in the 50s. And that's how I ended up inheriting the money to buy the house. So I had no family. I had no parents. I had no brothers or sisters. And I think one of the reasons I identified with the hate is they became like my family. So I didn't have parents to criticize me because they were dead. And I recall one of my professors of medicine, when I started the Haight-Ashbury Clinic, said, David, where did you go wrong? You were always such a promising young medical student. So I felt ostracized by the medical profession. Now I'm honored at 68. Then I was ostracized. And these gentlemen, I remember Scoop Nisker at KSAN. They would have I don't know if you remember this, Scoop. You'd have the musicians down there, and they'd play the concerts, and they had benefits for us. I forget You know, yeah. Old timers. I can't remember the guy's name, but he would go over the air, and we, the musicians were like, there wasn't a separation like there is now. In other words, we all felt part of this movement, and I felt part of it, and it's probably why I was so crushed when things started to go wrong, because this became my family, and these gentlemen accepted me, accepted all the people like me, and I had a role there. If you saw the Pulp Fiction, the Harvey Keitel film, I was the cleaner. In other words, they'd have the parties, there'd be blood and brains all over the place, they'd call me in to clean them up. And we took care of the all the kids at the concerts, Rock Medicine, Glenn Rasnick, Bob Student, all the people. So we were the ones that took care of the casualties. But again, Chet Helms and Bill Graham said, we have to take care of our own. It was a very different spirit then. We got to take care of our own, and we were the ones that took care of them. So I felt a real bond to them as this huge extended family and being part of this movement.
Rock Med is still rocking, you know.
Yeah.
Still rocking.
Well, and also, Dr. Smith, you know, there were a lot of, you know, there was a lot of tragedy there, in turn, be it, you know, related to drugs or whatever. But also, in a moment of levity, back in the green room, the story about the different names. Could you share that with us?
Well, they were talking about, I think Paul was rumpled foreskin on this. And so I said, well, you know, when they first came to the clinic in 67, the guy would come in and he'd had a good acid trip and he'd be, you know, like Moonbeam or White Rabbit, and then he'd have a bad acid trip the next day and he'd be Harvey Schwartz from Cleveland. And we said, please call yourself the same thing every day because we can't find your chart. So it was a very, very strange time. Everybody changed their name every day. And
but, you know, I think I saw some of your mice dancing at the Fillmore.
And they were smiling.
Dr. Smith has mentioned Bill Graham, the late concert promoter, and actually we had an audience question for you, Scoop. Do you have any favorite Bill Graham stories?
I used to be mistaken for Bill Graham. really, I'd walk down the street and people would say, hey, can I get some tickets to the Dead concert, you know? I always had a really good relationship with him. I liked him a lot. You know, I saw him in difficult situations with a lot of people, and you know, he would blow off sometimes. But I had a good connection with him.
Okay, Wavy.
Yeah, Bill only yelled at me once. It was at the US Festival. We were calling it the Dust Festival, and I was looking at getting the trash picked up. It was starting to get dark, and I discussed it with Bill, and Jackson Browne had finished his set, and I had hog farmers grab garbage bags and start cleaning up, and I'm feeling really smug because we picked up the trash, and I'm coming off the ramp, and Bill says, who told you to do that? He was going to do an encore. And I said, Bill, you told me that. And Killer looks at me and said, don't ever mess with the show. And I was petrified. The next day I saw him, I said, Bill, are you still mad at me? He says, my rage is only for the moment, my friend. Yes.
Well, and it's funny because, you know, we're commemorating the 40th anniversary of the Summer of Love here. On the 20th anniversary, I was interviewing Bill Graham, and I brought up the anniversary, and he really dismissed it. Oh, that was, you know, a media thing, you know, that sort of thing. And I suspect he'd be saying the same thing now. In your mind, you know, the Summer of Love, we've read stories that by then the magic had already kind of left the hate. But would any of you care to comment on that? Wavy.
I'd like to say that I bopped down. I had some kind of a speaking engagement and was walking down the hate, and I saw the Digger Free Store. And inside is a little swing in the window. And this beautiful African-American girl, maybe 5-6 years, was swinging back and forth in sunbeams. And I went inside, and I'm just watching her swinging back and forth. And this whisper voice comes in my ear and says, you want to help? And next thing I knew, I'd been folding clothes for 5 hours. And want to help came out of a guy named Emmett Grogan. who started the Diggers. And whenever I try to get something going for Seva or anything, I try and evoke Emmett's, want to help. And sometimes it really works. Emmett comes down and woo. Yeah.
You just mentioned Seva, and that was a question from the audience. And here's your chance to plug your foundation. How is that related to the you know, the Summer of Love and the whole vibe there? And tell us a little bit about the Seva Foundation.
Well, I rely on the same musicians. The Grateful Dead has been our house band pretty much for 30 years in one form or another. And the Airplane and Jackson and Crosby, Stills and Nash and all those kind of folks. We're working on Curable and Preventable Blindness in third world countries. We've done over 2 million sight-saving operations. And we also work bringing potable water into Central America and Chiapas. And in Native American, we're taking on diabetes on the American Indian Reservation with garden projects, talking circles of elders, and bringing back the buffalo. And they've actually named a stud buffalo after me, Wavy Gravy. Oh, yes, I'm not just ice cream and a pretty face.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guest tonight, Dr. David E. Smith, Scoop Nisker, Paul Krasner, and Wavy Gravy, celebrating the Summer of Love at 40, the roots of a counterculture. And here's a good question from the audience. I'm paraphrasing it, actually. But is Burning Man the love child of the Summer of Love? Everybody's thinking about that one. Wavy leaps to the microphone.
I really, really got off at Burning Man. It just tickled me. It was like all these lights and things flashing around. It's like suddenly somebody plugged in the Rainbow Gathering. That's what it kind of reminds me of. Suddenly they were given electricity. It was just, and everything is, nothing is sold, and you have to carry out everything you bring in, and it's a lot of beautiful people. Jose Anguele said it. He said, the flowers blossom and humans art. And these humans are arting all over the desert floor. It's just magnificent.
Scoop Nisker, I think you were going to add something.
I was going to just say that I think it's an extension of the Summer of Love and that feeling of community that people really yearn for, both community and celebration. And I think that's a lot of what the Summer of Love was about, just as a moment of a movement of people. The first human being was held in 1967. And it was a celebration of just being, which was so unusual, you know, in America, where everything is about doing and what you can accomplish and how much you can, make. And here was a whole group of people, the children, really, of affluence, saying, "We're just going to celebrate existence. We want a different consciousness," you know, and it. That experiment continues, I think, to this day.
Well, again, I have a different perspective.
This is Dr. Smith.
I don't get Burning Man. And I guess one of the things that troubles me, I get Wavy Gravy, I get the Hog Farm, I so much admire what he's doing in third world countries, but what I have seen is a split between culture and social action. For example, one of the things our Smith Family Foundation supports is a free clinic in Commonwealth, Common Ground Free Clinic in New Orleans, helping with the poor in a hurricane-ravaged area. And a lot of the volunteers come from San Francisco, imbued with the spirit. In fact, one of the things that was most moving to me was a woman down there working, and she says, "Well, my mother used to volunteer at Haight-Ashbury Free Clinics, and that's how I got this spirit." So they like music, but music is not what drives them. And then Burning Man, to me, I mean, is kind of like a party, you know. And that's not the way it was in the Summer of Love. It was that.
Not that there's anything wrong with parties.
But all I'm saying is that the music transformed your life. It was the driving force for attitudinal change of people like me. That then translate that into social action. And now it's the music's over here with agents and big money, and the social action's over there. So I view Wavy Gravy and the Hog Farm and what he's doing as separate from Burning Man as night and day. And I'd like to see more of Wavy Gravy and less of Burning Man. Mm-hmm.
Wavy, you wanted to add something there?
But I'm just saying that there's all this other stuff going on. The Concert for the Earth was fantastic. All these cities all over the planet kicking it, and try the album to save Darfur, that the stuff that Bono is doing. And the stuff that's coming out of Al Gore and that whole revolution. I'm feeling that this is the time now. It's happening again, and it's happening now. And now it's all there is.
Looking at our audience tonight, I would assume that for many, tonight's program is a trip down memory lane. For others, it's a history lesson. And for the latter, we have a question from the audience about the military angle, the military connection. They write, the San Francisco Bay Area was a huge staging area for the Vietnam War. Young men were being sent there from all over the country and needed to party. Hippie icons like Jerry Garcia, Hendrix were veterans. I think Country Joe was as well. Obviously, we've got a war going on right now, this action in Iraq. And I don't know if any of you would like to relate to what was happening with Vietnam and how that related to the Summer of Love during the summer of 67. Anybody want to field that?
Again, I have one comment there.
Dr. Smith.
That the anti-war movement was everything. Here was a total non-social action guy from UC Med Center marching in an anti-war protest. Probably Wavy was leading it, and I was in the back, but that was so out of character for me. But you're talking about the protest against the war. One of the unknown parts of the Haight-Ashbury was the Vietnam War vets against the war came back and settled there. Country Joe McDonald was the musician. Glenn Rasnick, who became head of Rock Medicine, was a Vietnam vet. Jack McCluskey was a medic. And these individuals had been traumatized by the war. They settled on Waller and Steiner and Waller. No, Waller Street. I know where it is in my mind. But and there was swords to plowshares. And then they came to our Haight-Ashbury Clinic drug detox facility. Now, this is a history lesson for people in the audience. You read about all that rehab in the paper. In 1969, when we were detoxing addicts, it was a criminal offense. I was committing about 100 felonies a day because I was detoxing addicts on an outpatient basis. Well, the vets came to our clinic for detox. How did that detox get started? A Creedence Clearwater benefit by Bill Graham. And then suddenly, the government started wanting to give me grants. And I said, what's going on here? 2 years ago, you tried to arrest me, and now you want to give me money, and we're doing the same thing. Well, it's because those vets came to the clinic, and the government said, we cannot put our boys in jail for getting strung out in a foreign and a popular war. That's how we got all those federal grants. So we can talk about the anti-war movement, and these gentlemen were much more involved in it than I was, but what troubles me is how we ignored the vets that came back traumatized. You can be for or against the war, but there's soldiers over there getting beat out, strung out. And I agree with Wavy. I think 2008 is going to look a lot more like 1968 because we're already treating those vets come back. I mean, how do you think you drive a tank for 3 days and not sleep? You take speed. And the speed's been given them by the military over there so they can be better soldiers. But they come out here and they're traumatized, brain damaged, getting loaded, and I don't hear any discussion about that. In fact, I hope the equivalent of Vietnam Vets Against the War gets started. I know that Glenn Rasnick, when the vets come back, he goes out and greets them. So I'd like to see some of that. Some I'm for the war, I'm against the war, I happen to be against the war, but our troops are getting beat up and massacred there, and the VA is doing nothing for them.
Paul?
Yeah.
Paul Krasner, you wanted to address this as well?
I do know for a fact that the military was sensed and researched and realized that the counterculture was a threat to... because the counterculture was essentially against the Vietnam War and were not likely to want to participate in it. But I want to go beyond that, because it wasn't just the war. The counterculture was a threat to the American economy. They had think tanks observing and extrapolating and could see that young people were making their own clothes. They weren't buying them. They were sharing automobiles. They didn't get insurance. They took care of each other. They used candles instead of light bulbs. And you can go down the list of all the things that added to the notion that this was not going to be the consumer economy that they needed. And so there was a government attempt to neutralize the counterculture. I've been doing research on this. Somebody's trying to set up an interview with me to talk to a former FBI guy who was in what they called the hippie squad, where they taught him such things as how to roll a joint, the better to infiltrate communes. And it was a threat beyond. They weren't even on a religious level. You know, young people were leaving Western religions of control and becoming involved with Eastern disciplines of liberation. So it was a threat to the country on a lot of different levels besides sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
I'd really like to comment on that, because everything he says is true, and you find it hard to believe. These FBI informants infiltrated the free clinic movement. I found this out later in the Carter administration when I happened to see my dossier, and I was branded a communist, and all I was trying to do was take care of poor people without charging them. And what they did was they did everything Paul said, but the part I did, that they would come when we were organizing the free clinics. I was president of the National Free Clinic Council, and they would play lefter than thou. Whatever you did, they would say, storm City Hall. They'd do everything they can to disorganize. And these were FBI informants, because they didn't want the free clinic movement or anything to organize. And so it's almost like every conspiracy that you can think of, it was worse. And I imagine it's probably happening right now. And people try to organize. They try to deliver health care to poor people. They try to organize anti-war movement. I mean, this was before Watergate, when probably their tactics were quite primitive. But I saw in writing FBI agitators that did this thing that Paul said and acted like free clinic workers and played the lefter than thou game, and I never could figure out why we couldn't organize. And now I realized it wasn't the free clinic workers that couldn't organize, it was the FBI informants, agitators that disrupted it.
Mm. Just show of hands, do you all think you've got an FBI file out there that's at least a couple pages long? Yeah, okay. Oh, and in the audience, too. Wow, and wearing it like a badge of courage, aren't we? Yes.
I'm sure mine is standing.
Scoop Nisker wanted to add something.
I wanted to connect with what Paul was saying about it being more than an anti-war movement, that the Summer of Love and the whole hippie movement was really a lot more than just anti-war. In fact, the hippies were not quite as political as people think. It really was a spiritual, I think, revolution, and partly it had to do, and I think if there's any legacy, really, of the hippie, it is in all the meditation and yoga centers all over the country now, and it is in the environmental movement, the ecology
yes.
movement. And it may have been instigated by the drugs, and I think the drugs certainly had something to do with it, seeing a different vision of reality, understanding your consciousness in a different way, experimenting with the new psychologies that were starting to emerge in the 60s. It was, after taking, you know, some substances, it was understanding the delicate nature of the interface between human and other species. It was understanding that you live on a planet. All of those things got there, were seeded. All those understandings were seeded in that time. And it wasn't just a, you know, drugs and rock and roll and music and anti-war. That there really was a core sea change in the way people regarded their consciousness and reality.
Well, and let me use that as a lead into the next question, and Scoop, you probably gave half of your answer just then. But I'd like to go down the panel here and have each of you address this question. What is the best thing to have come out of the Summer of Love, and what is the worst thing to have come out of the Summer of Love? And
wasn't that a YouTube question?
Today's USA Today poll. I guess Wavy Gravy will start with you.
Well, the Sharon and Karen part is the best thing. It's the interconnectedness. We realize that we're all the same person trying to shake hands with ourselves, and that's quite a task, and war is a very complicated way of getting acquainted.
And the worst thing?
Just hippies dying on smack. Yeah. A bunch of dead hippies. My friends, Janice, Jimmy. Ouch.
Yeah. Paul Krasner.
I think the best thing was the sense of community, because a lot of people who were the only freak on their block suddenly came to Mecca here and realized that it was like coming to a Martian convention. And I guess the worst thing was the exploitation of that sense of community by people who wanted to take advantage of a whole community that was filled with trust. And when you find trust, if you have an agenda, you try and take advantage of that trust. So that was the worst thing, I think.
Scoop Nisker.
Well, I just said that I thought, you know, environmentalism, the ecology movement really was the best thing that came out of that time, I think. The worst thing, I think, is a sense of idealism that we fostered, a kind of naive idealism that we really thought we were going to change the whole system around in a, you know, within a generation. There was a lack of patience and a lack of kind of understanding the long-term nature of real change. And I think that kind of false optimism that we had, it lingers into the hippies didn't know anything. You know, they were just these silly people running around saying, give us the world, and we want the world, and we want it now. You know, I mean, we actually chanted that, you know? Can you believe that?
We had no exit strategy.
That's true. So anyway, I think that's the worst thing.
Okay. There's even an active movement that we had going to buy back the earth and give it away so it wouldn't be for sale anymore. And we bought, 700 acres in Norton, Vermont, which was just recently the feds tried to seize it. And with the help of Howard Dean and Ben and Jerry, we turned it into a state park.
Speaking of Ben and Jerry, I understand they're going to have a new flavor now with peach and mint, and it's going to be called Impeachment.
Yum, yum.
Bada bing. Can I use this gavel for a rim shot there? I don't know. And Dr. Smith, I mean, you know, you were there treating a lot of folks, a lot of the casualties, but in your mind, the best thing?
The best, I think, was the merger of music, culture, and social action. Scoop has already mentioned many of the things that came out of the environmental movement. But remember, the gay rights movement came out of that period, the women's rights movement. I was treating criminal abortion at San Francisco General Hospital, and then suddenly the women and pro-choice said, no, the world has to be different. And Janis Joplin got us to start a women's needs center so we could take care of the women. She just lived a couple blocks away from where we were. So that was all very exciting and positive and continues on today with the free clinic movement, Wavy Gravy's work. The worst for me were the drugs. One thing I've learned is that any movement fueled by drugs is doomed to failure. Doesn't mean I'm a Kerry Nation, drug conservative, but I want to just quote Country Joe McDonald. He said, we got everything right but the drugs. And it turned into speed and heroin and it went down the tubes.
But don't you think, we were talking before about the infiltration of the movement, where did those bad drugs come from, I think, is a question that has to be explored.
Well, I don't know where it came from. All I know is that it was a disaster.
There's a big difference between smack, crack, and smoking flowers. Well, I say you got to qualify your drugs.
I'm not saying where it came from. All I know is that I remember Timothy Leary lecturing his turn on, tune in, drop out, or turn on, tune in, drop out, and then we took him over to see some bad acid trips. He didn't want to see it. You know, he doesn't want to see the casualties. So there's the good side and the bad side, but we dealt with the bad side. And when I was just down in New Orleans with all these young idealistic volunteers, I say, I'm no conservative about drugs, but I say beware of alcohol and drugs, and they are.
Can I ask, I don't know if anybody will want to address this, was there any redeeming value to the drugs done during the counterculture movement before the drugs were bad, before LSD was illegal? Did it contribute to a mind expansion, or would the mind expansion have happened without the LSD?
Let me start off with that because...
Dr. Smith.
I took LSD and had a spiritual experience. I don't want to romanticize it. I have 4 kids, 3 grandchildren. I know parents are concerned about it, but I would not have done... I would not be here today, and I would not be doing what I'm doing if I hadn't had a spiritual experience with LSD. No doubt about it. There's no question that to some of us, the psychedelics were incredible, mind-altering experiences. Scoop talked about this nature, bonding with nature, seeing the air move and anything. Well, maybe he knew about it before he took acid. I didn't. And it changed my entire life, and it bonded me with the music. The problem is, stopped. I didn't do any more, and actually I quit drinking, and now I'm in AA and 12-step recovery. But for a lot of people, it didn't stop. In other words, if you could say, take the psychedelic experience, have a spiritual experience, change your view of the world, and stop, then we could keep the good. But the problem is, particularly with the young people, they don't stop there. And I don't know what the answer is. I don't have any answer to the drug problem other than the fact that I just read in the newspaper now that the Afghanistan turned out a record crop of opium. Heroin is skyrocketing. The overdose deaths are skyrocketing. The military is protecting heroin traffic so they can fight against the terrorists in the Mideast. It's just like Vietnam all over again. And we have to question that and hopefully learn the lessons. I don't know what the lessons are other than addicts have the right to care, and we need to include them in our responsibility to help people and figure out why so many good things went wrong.
Wavy wanted to say something.
I just heard him mention the music, and I think that something ought to happen to honor. We made this Bill Graham Civic. There ought to be something for Chet Helms, at least a boulevard. Something.
And on our radio program on KFOG Radio last week, Scoop Nisker proposed a tomb to the unknown hippie in Washington. Is
not
that
right? Not a tomb, a statue.
Oh, okay.
But on this whole good-bad thing, I just wanted to mention something. Lawrence Ferlinghetti told me that at the Human Bein in Golden Gate Park in January of 1967, you know, all this whole pantheon of great heroes of beatniks, and Tim Leary was there, and Gary Snyder, and Alan was there playing his harmonium and chanting Om, and at one point, Ferlinghetti said that Allen Ginsberg leaned over to him and said, "What if we have it all wrong?"
In the issue, the Best of the Bay issue of the Bay Guardian that came out yesterday, named 2007 local hero Wavy Gravy. And
what's this? You didn't know that?
No.
Did you know that?
You didn't know it.
Here, someone. There you go.
Holy moly.
You didn't know, thanks to the audience member who gave it to us. Yeah, you can get that framed. My question is going to be this, though. Just about everybody on this panel here is considered an icon of the 60s. And are there any misconceptions about you that you would like to clear up? If we go to Wikipedia, is there anything that's wrong if we type your name in? Wavy Gravy, you want to start?
I did not put the acid in the Kool-Aid at Watts.
Okay.
I spent the whole time on the mic saying, the Kool-Aid on the right is for the children. The Kool-Aid on the left is the electric Kool-Aid. Get it? Now, once again, the Kool-Aid on the right is for... But people be dancing for... 3-4 hours to the Grateful Dead, and they were just looking for something wet, and wet was maybe 100 micrograms a swallow. But it was Claire Brush who reported to Tom Wolfe that I did it. She was a reporter from the L.A. Free Press who was stoned out of her mind. And I still have mothers beat me with umbrellas because of this thing, and I did not do it.
Okay, good. I'm glad we cleared that up. Paul Krasner, anything floating out there about you that's wrong?
I'm thinking.
Okay.
Let me come back to that after.
Okay,
then.
All right. Scoop Nisker? No, they've got it right?
I don't think of myself as an icon, really. I mean, I hope I'm not an icon yet. You know, as a practicing Buddhist, we try to get rid of the I. So, you know.
Whoa.
Maybe I'm just a con.
And Dr. David E. Smith, anything out there about you? Maybe something in your FBI file that you'd like to correct?
I think history will, in all these different perspectives, and hopefully this whole show will give a broader reflection of this complicated period. I think... The thing that troubles me, I heard it in 67, and then I heard it later, that addiction treatment creates addicts. That's why you have to close down addiction treatment. That was something used to deny a permit for the Haight-Ashbury Clinic. And this idea that if you treat addicts, that's why they become addicts, is total nonsense. And I've seen that on the web. I'm not pro or anti-drug. I am pro taking care of people that have problems. If you don't have a problem, you don't see a doctor. You know, don't come to me if you don't have a problem. But this idea that if we treat people with addiction problems, that will encourage them to use drugs, I think to this audience it sounds ridiculous, but that's being said all over the United States. That's why the 80% of people in the criminal justice system have substance abuse problems. Only 5% get treatment, and policy for addiction in the United States is jail, because if you fund treatment, it will encourage addiction. And that has been something that I've seen attributed to me, is that one of my supporters in San Francisco said, David Smith started the Haight-Ashbury Clinic. The drug revolution started in the United States, in Haight-Ashbury. It spread throughout the United States. So David Smith's responsible for ruining the youth of America. And the problem is that politicians believe that crap. And there's always this conservative element that will say jail, not treatment. And then we fill up the jails, and then we got to empty them out because you got too many people there. And this is, the drug war is a failed policy. It's an economically disastrous failed policy. Supported by political myths like addiction treatment creates addicts. And so I think that is the biggest misconception of my lifetime work that I think needs to be corrected.
Yeah, we've corrected it for the record on the radio, so there you go. Paul Krasner, you came up with something.
Oh, I remembered. I've been accused of a couple of murders that
you weren't even close.
Deny. One was Phil Spector accused me of killing Lenny Bruce, and.
Is this serious? Are you serious?
Yeah, he did. This was at a museum in Syracuse. John Lennon and Yoko Ono were having a showing there, And they brought me to the special VIP room, which was very crowded. Ringo Starr was there, and Phil Spector was there. And as I entered the room, he just pointed, you killed Lenny Bruce. And so that's one wrong accusation. And then Valerie Solanas, I met her in New York, and I admired her as a pamphleteer, even if I didn't agree with her idea of castrating all men. So I empathized with her, and I lent her $50, and a couple of days later, I didn't know, but she used that money to buy a gun and shoot Andy Warhol. And so a lot of the people from Andy Warhol's crowd accused me of hiring her to kill Andy Warhol. So I'd like to set the record straight on that.
Don't you hate that when you're falsely accused of trying to kill Andy Warhol? You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking tonight with Dr. David E. Smith, Scoop Nisker, Paul Krasner, and Wavy Gravy, celebrating the summer of love at 40, the roots of a counterculture. Some have argued that the counterculture movement helped end a war, the Vietnam War. Some have argued that the counterculture movement helped get a rotten president out of office. Move to present day. There have been some large anti-war demonstrations, but we haven't seen it to the same degree that we saw in the 60s and 70s. Is it because there is not a mandatory draft these days, or are there other reasons Paul Krasner wants to address this?
I definitely think it's partly, administration knows that. That's why they don't want to have a draft. That's why they keep redeploying these military people, and they come back crazy from fatigue and insanity. It's a matter of were we talking about short-term memory loss? I'll come back to this thought.
Raise your hand when it comes back to you. In the meantime, Wavy Gravy.
What are we talking about?
I haven't a clue. Paul Krasner and then back to Wavy.
Well, the point is that this is why I remember last year Latinos in Los Angeles, a million people came out in the streets to protest what was going on with the immigration situation. And the reason why, when there was a draft, students ran around with lapel buttons that said, "Not with my body, you don't." And so if there were a draft today, they know that there would be more people on the streets. And my thought is that we should hire guest marchers from Mexico to do the job that Americans don't want to do.
And Wavy Gravy.
No, I just remember how many tens of millions of people that we put on the streets all over this planet that were totally ignored by the administration. I mean, tens of millions, and the young people are really, really against this war and are now beginning to show it electronically instead of with their bodies in the streets. And I think that's very exciting.
Do any of you ever get back to Haight-Ashbury, stroll the streets? I know, Wavy, I saw you at a Ben and Jerry's benefit
one day. I saw lids on the corner, but they were lids to my ice cream flavor.
Ah, okay. Anybody
else
ever? For
camp scholarships, yeah.
I do every morning at 9 a.m.
Yeah.
I still have my Haight. Walk my dogs, and I can walk to every place I've lived and worked in the last 47 years in the Haight-Ashbury. And if you want to join me, just be at Frederick and Clayton, and I walk down to Ashbury, down by the Grateful Dead house, by Janis Joplin's house, past the clinic with my dogs. I was very thrilled that Tom Brokaw joined me on my dog walk. And the thing that was very exciting is that he said, "Well, David, I interviewed you 40 years ago. You look a lot older now." And I said, "So do you, Tom. And we're all a lot older." And my twin grandsons who are here tonight, Alex and Ash, and my daughter Sabri, and my wife Millicent were with us. And we're in front of the Haight-Ashbury Clinic, and he has grandchildren, so he held one of my grandsons, and he threw up all over Tom's coat. I have many memories, but it's not the past for me. The Haight-Ashbury is a very present reality, and I'm very interested in these gentlemen's perspective, including the outside perspectives, as to why, when the healthcare system is crumbling, we're in this foreign and unpopular war, we've got an administration that this is totally insensitive, where is the protest? I don't know that. I'm not a politician. I don't understand it. But where is the protest against going on? In 67, the same dysfunctional elements were happening, and there was large protest. Maybe it was what Wavy said. Maybe the protest is over the internet.
I think Scoop Nisker wants to address
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I think that there is an economic factor that we really were. It was a generation that came into affluence. America had just become a superpower. We've certainly wasted our power, quickly. But we had just come of age as a superpower, and the youth could live on very little, get a job, earn a little money, take a year off. We would go to India when I got involved in studying Buddhism, and go to India for a year, come back, work for 6 months, go back for another. I mean, we were the kings of the world, and in terms of wealth and freedom, and I think now the crunch of economic priorities, and the young people are getting careers and they want to get established, and there's a lot of fear involved, and there's not as much room to experiment and hang out for a while and explore your dreams and your consciousness. I think that has a lot to do with it.
Let me ask. Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
I think you're right.
I don't know if any of you want to address this, but a lot of people, as they get older, they become more conservative. I don't see that with this panel so much. Why is that so? Why have you stuck to your 60s ideals?
Let me just mention
Dr.
one
Smith.
Thing. I don't see that. For example, the agent of change for healthcare in the United States is not youth anymore. It's the elderly. I was just... a couple years ago, I was awarded the Senior Worker of State of California. I stand before you as a Senior Worker of the Year. And I said in my talk, don't trust anybody under 60. To me, my generation are the ones that are saying, let's change things. Let's change the healthcare system. The elderly are becoming active in terms of healthcare reform. The question is not where the seniors are. It's where the youth are. And again, maybe I've romanticized that period, but what I have seen is the people that went through that period got a spirit. And they may be retired now, and they may be teachers now, and they may be software workers now, or Silicon Valley worker, but they have that spirit, and they want to change things. And somehow or another, the youth haven't gotten the spirit except in very limited areas, and I don't know why.
And I'm going to, sorry if anybody else wanted to address that, maybe afterwards with the audience you can. Unfortunately, we've reached a point in our program where there is time for one last question, and I've got this big, thick stack here of questions I didn't get to, so sorry to the audience members, but I'm sure you'll agree we've covered a lot here. The final question is this, for each of you, a single favorite memory that sticks out from the Summer of Love, 1967. Wavy Gravy, I know that's going back a ways, but do you have a favorite memory?
A memory that just popped into my head is I'm bouncing ahead a little bit to the moratorium, and Pete Seeger is on stage singing "All We Are Saying Is Give Peace a Chance," and Mitch Miller jumps on the stage and says, "Give me a sea of V's," and everybody's swaying back and forth, and Abby Hoffman leans over and says, "They got Norman Luboff in the wings." And I says, "Abby, we don't need to do this anymore. Middle America has taken over the peace movement." At that moment, somebody left a bunch of doves, and one of them pooped on my third eye. Abby says, "There's your answer."
Okay. Paul Krasner, a favorite memory from Summer of Love?
Well, the backstory is that I was a virgin until I was 26. And then the sexual revolution came. And I remember I was on Haight Street and walking along, and I saw a young woman across the street who I thought I remembered as an old friend. And I waved to her, and she waved to me, and she came across the street, and we were talking a while, and I realized we had never met before. But I got laid anyway.
And I can't believe in this one-hour program that's going to be the only reference to free love. Scoop Nisker, a favorite memory.
Well, it's hard to separate one thing out of that that melange of wonderful experiences. I think listening to Ravi Shankar at Monterey Pop Festival when I was on LSD and swaying with a whole circle of people and just feeling like all the cultures are coming together, all, you know, love is in the air. We really are going to make a big change in the world. It's really, peace is really going to happen. It's going to work. You know, that feeling, and I had it many different times, I think, through that year, was just, you know, sweet.
Okay. And the last word will come from Dr. David Smith.
My favorite memory is June 7th, 1967. Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic opens up, has my name on the door, David E. Smith, MD and Associates, had $100 in our pocket, and 250 young people were lined up around the street. How in heaven's name did they even find out we existed? 24/7, and I felt, now my life has meaning. And that is an incredible memory. Joan Baez was singing in the waiting room, music was all over, and I thought this was the most incredible time of my life.
What a great way to end the show.
Our thanks to Dr. David E. Smith, Scoop Nisker, Paul Krasner, and Wavy Gravy as we celebrate the Summer of Love at 40 and the roots of the counterculture. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Peter Finch, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion is adjourned.